Nazareth from 1975, a song called Hair of the Dog. The title in that, though, has nothing to do with a hangover cure. Dogs and cats move front and center in our conversation tonight. You know, different cultures eat different things. We all understand that. We eat cows and pigs, and some parts of the world they eat dogs and cats. And I suppose we can accept that to some degree, but when you hear what goes on inside the dog meat trade and these dog meat farms, I think you're going to be very surprised. It's an issue that's just now sort of popping onto the public radar screen here in the U.S. And when we come back, two of the people who are on the front lines of this battle will join us to talk about it and other issues. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the program. We welcome now two first-time guests. Kitty Block is the Vice President of HSI, Humane Society International. She oversees HSUS efforts in international treaties and agreements for endangered species. She's fought on behalf of dolphins and whales, has a law degree from George Washington University, and has taken on the U.S. government and beaten them in federal court three different times. Adam Periscindola. Adam, sorry about that that pronunciation, you can correct me in a moment, is the Director of Animal Protection and Crisis Response for Humane Society International. He's done a lot of frontline stuff himself and helped secure convictions against dozens of large-scale animal abusers and the first ever prosecution for felony animal cruelty at a slaughter plant. Do we have Adam? We don't have Adam. Well, Kitty Block, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening.
Hey, can we start? Let's start with dog meat trade. You know, I don't think it's an issue that's on the public radar screen here in the U.S. yet, but it's one that I started reading about it. I didn't know much at all about it. The horrible stuff that goes on in this is something I think that will certainly grab people's attention here in the near future. What can you tell us about it?
Sure. Yeah, it's been going on for many, many years, and it's really a gruesome commercial practice. This is not a local thing that's happening. It's not a backyard type of thing. It's really a commercial scale, and it's in a number of Asian countries. And it's you know, sometimes it's people's pets. It's they're either taking them off the streets. One country, South Korea, they actually farm them, like you have farm to raise farm animals, but the conditions are just horrific. No regulations, no rules, and these animals are slaughtered by the thousands, and they're served up in restaurants, their stores. I don't know how many of your viewers and listeners have been traveling in some of these countries and have seen it themselves, but it's really, really horrible, horrible practice.
I read on one website, I just don't know if it's exaggeration or not, that it's some believe that the more pain and terror the animal suffers before it dies, the better the meat tastes because adrenaline is released into the body. Is that true?
Yeah, there's definitely some of that. And it's one of these things where we just have to work on education, understanding the suffering of these animals and really what the suffering is and how it happens. And so we just think it's a matter of working with the people, helping educate, spending the time to talk about what this trade means, the health implications, the fact that some of these animals that they're consuming are pets. We're making breakthroughs.
Well, how do you do that? Let me approach it this way first. I can see people sitting at home saying, look, you know, South Koreans can eat whatever they want. They eat dogs, we eat cows, you know. It's a cultural difference.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are done in the name of culture. I mean, there's some of the most heinous and horrible practices, the United States included, many countries around the world. And as we evolve as a society and become aware of the suffering that's inflicted and those that we are perpetrating it on, we have to modify our behavior. That is how a society is best handled as it moves forward. And so in a lot of these countries we're talking about, dog meat is actually is declining. It is something that's part of an older generation's diet. It's not how the younger people want to view themselves, and they want to be more associated with adopting humane practices. So we are working with a lot of them. It's some of these efforts, you know, we've helped amplify their voices. Again, a lot of this is homegrown. In China, there are activists now who are encircling these dog trucks, these dog meat trucks when they see them, and they're confiscating the animals, and they're adopting these animals out and trying to find homes. So it's not just a, you know, this sort of Western value, we're coming over and we're dictating to them what to do. they're actually seeing in many cases how awful and abusive this practice is.
You know, Wayne Pacelli was in the, joined us in the first hour and telling us about how difficult it is to fight these battles in Washington and in state legislatures. I can only imagine the difficulties in trying to fight it on a global scale, the cultural differences and how different people see animal welfare issues. You've got a tough job.
Yes, I mean, it is difficult, but it's also so rewarding. Because I don't really think that a Western value or any one nation or any one culture is sort of has a monopoly on animal ethos or animal protection. I think Wayne a few days ago did a blog on India, where a lot of this is born, this ethos for animals. There's different parts of the world that have have their own way of approaching it and a way of addressing it, and we don't own the market on it. It really is sort of a global understanding and a global compassion, and it's just a matter of time and how you help work with it, develop it, and amplify the voices of those who care.
I'm told that Adam has now joined us. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, can you just can you pronounce your last name for us? I think I just mangled it a minute ago.
Sure, it's Paris Condola.
Okay, great. Adam, as I mentioned in the introduction, you have a lot of experience on the front lines yourself. Kitty and I were just talking about the international trade in dogs, and Americans have their own issues with dog cruelty, specifically puppy mills and dog fighting rings, and that's something that you have a lot of experience with. Isn't dog fighting pretty much illegal everywhere by now? Is that still around?
Well, it is illegal everywhere in the United States and all of the U.S. territories. It is a felony, actually, in all 50 U.S. states. But unfortunately, there are still countries in the world where it's not illegal to fight dogs. So there are still areas where, you know, we are working to pass laws to ban dog fighting.
And I know the puppy mill issue. It seems like HSUS and other animal welfare organizations have made great strides in trying to shut down puppy mills. But in looking at your website, it seems like that is still a major issue, that for millions of people who, for example, buy dogs and cats at pet stores, just haven't got the message. What's the status of that fight? How are things going?
I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress over the last few years on the puppy mill issue, but what we saw initially was that a lot of people became sort of more educated on buying dogs from pet stores. Certainly the amount of pet stores that sell dogs has decreased. I mean, there are still, you know, way too many, in my opinion, but what we saw at the same time was sort of a rise in puppy millers selling their dogs over the internet. And so this has been sort of our real push for the last, you know, year or two is to educate the public on dogs that are bought over the internet. And often, you know, of course, on the website, the puppy looks like a beautiful puppy sitting in somebody's bed, you know, living room on their couch. But the reality is, when we've done raids on these facilities, is that, you know, they are kept in these horrendous conditions that we've seen, you know, that are rows and rows of cages that they spend their entire lives on. And so we've been really trying to educate the public on, you know, what you're seeing on the website is not necessarily the way that dogs are being kept, and that we really need to do our research, you know, when it comes to wanting to buy dogs as pets. And of course, you know, my first, my biggest desire is that people, you know, try to adopt a dog first before buying one.
Kitty, I'm not sure if you have dealt with the puppy mill issue on the domestic front, but I'll ask you this. I mean, I read the responses from the pet store industry, and they'll say our puppies come from breeders, not puppy mills. They'll say all our puppies are from USDA inspected facilities. We know they're not from puppy mills. Do you have a response to that?
I actually don't do any of the domestic work, so I'm going to defer to Adam on that.
Okay,
question.
Adam, what do you say to those guys?
Well, we have documented through in our investigations that many instances where pet stores where we'll send somebody in who will ask the pet store where the animals come from. They'll assure them that they're not from puppy mills, that they're from, you know, sort of family breeders, I think they usually call them. But when they get the paperwork and they trace back where these dogs come from, they often come from very notorious puppy mills. And many times they don't even come directly from the puppy mill. They're sold from the puppy mill to a broker, sort of drives around and buys up dogs from various puppy mills and then transports them to the pet store. And it is true that some of these dogs are USDA, that these breeders are USDA inspected, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there are not issues that are occurring on the property. We have found puppy mills with some pretty horrendous conditions, and in fact have found USDA reports that list the horrendous conditions that occur on many of these facilities. So just because it is USDA inspected is no guarantee that that the conditions are humane on that property.
Kitty, I'm going to jump back to the international stage. It seems like every time I read an article about the ivory trade, about rhino horns, about elephants, it's bad news. The numbers keep shrinking, the poachers keep winning, and it seems to be there are still ignorant people who believe that some rhino horn has miraculous medical healing powers, so they'll pay almost anything for these horns, and the animals are in big trouble. Give me an estimate of the situation on the ivory front and those elephants and rhinos in particular.
Sure. Yeah, it is. I mean, we are at a critical stage right now. I mean, there have been many governments, the U.S. included, that have felt a small legal trade is fine. I mean, if any of the ivory that's used, some of the money goes back into conservation. And we have said for years there can't be any market for these products, because as long as there's a price tag on these animals' heads, they're going to die. And so we have worked systematically at a UN agreement to try to ban the import and trade in any of these products. In some places we've been successful, other places it's been very difficult. And so what we do is we work on these demand reduction campaigns. We work in Vietnam, we work in a number of countries in China, and we try to educate. I mean, in Vietnam, for instance, they're buying the rhino horn powder, which is, you know, more than expensive than gold, and they're using it for whatever ails you. And so we're working with the women's associations, children's organizations, drafting, you know, children's books, talking about what rhino horn actually is. It's nothing more than the carotene of your fingernails. It's not going to cure you. And in fact, if you take this product in lieu of real medicine, you're going to be sick. And so what we're trying to do is just sort of demystify what these products are and what the true impact is, and that is the extinction of these incredible animals that have roamed the earth for so long that the greed that has been sort of fostered over the years has taken control. So we are working in on the ground in many nations trying to just reduce the demand and educate about what this product is and what it's doing to these animals. There's more an awareness now. I mean, the U.S. is the second largest importer of elephant ivory. I mean, we all think China and all these other countries, we're second to China. And so we really have a responsibility to do what we can in the United States and around the globe.
How is that even allowed? I thought it was illegal. I have a general idea that we're the good guys in this. How is that allowed?
Well, there's exemptions. There are exemptions for certain products, ivory that is over a certain age, antique ivory, and then there's also the illegal trade. And so between these loopholes that we are working to tighten state by state now and some of the illegal market, that's how it's been coming in. And so a lot of countries where they have banned it, they're exceptions to that ban. And we are really trying to go in the U.S. state by state, close it, and then country by country.
I don't know if this is a question for Kitty or Adam, but I read an article earlier this month about something called the Sportsman's Act that's been kicking around in Washington, which was sort of relates to the illegal ivory trade, creating a new kind of an exemption under sort of the cover of deer hunters and duck hunters. Do you know anything about that, Adam? Or Kitty?
I don't actually, Kitty. Do you?
Well, I'm not sure, and I was actually going to try to look it up as you're speaking. I mean, I'm generally aware of it, but how it applies directly. I mean, there is new legislation in the U.S., and then there's state legislation that we're working on. I'm not exactly sure where this one falls. I apologize.
Okay, well, back to you, Kitty. One battle I know you worked on was dealing with dolphins. You know, I sort of thought this was an issue that was resolved, that we can ease our conscience by eating certain brands of tuna fish because it says the labels say it's dolphin safe, no dolphins die. You've had to go to court, I guess, a couple of times to make sure that the government's doing what the law says it should do, right?
Right. This is the long, hard fought and hard won on many occasions, but then receding victories. This is the tuna dolphin issue, where there is encircling of dolphins and trapping them with nets to capture the tuna below and killing dolphins in the process. And we have been, Humane Society of the United States and Humane Society International has worked for literally decades on this issue to protect the dolphins. And we've had, you know, lots of successes in the courts and in public opinion. But what's happened is it's gone to the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And as a result of that, we've lost on certain trade barriers, so an embargo. So we have to, dolphin deadly tuna does come into this country. You just need to look for that label, the label that we've known and trusted for many years, where it's dolphin safe. And you have to just look for that label to make sure you don't buy any products. But we continue to work on the international front, which is through this international agreement, where Mexico is fighting to weaken the label, weaken the standards. So putting a dolphin-safe label on their products, even though they are chasing, encircling, and netting dolphins. So it's sort of a globalization issue now, and we're working on it on that front. But this is going to become a major consumer campaign again if, in fact, Mexico is successful, continues to be successful in the WTO.
But right now, if I buy tuna that has the dolphin-safe label, is it really dolphin-safe tuna?
Yes, it is. And that's the federal legislation that we worked on in 1997. They did weaken it, but we were able at the last minute to work with a number of really key legislators, Barbara Boxer in particular, that if the science showed that dolphins were not recovering, continuing to die, then the label could not be changed or weakened. And so the science showed that. So right now in the United States, absolutely, as long as you see that dolphin safe logo, you're good in what you're doing, and you're buying tuna that did not directly target and kill dolphins.
A similar sort of question about whales, and we'll come back to Adam in a moment. But you fought that battle as well, and you know it seemed like so much change was enacted regarding protecting whales years ago. Yet now it seems every time I read about at some conference of the international whaling industry, they make compromises that allows more and more whaling, and it's just unbelievable. It's still going on.
It's one of these things. You're right. You're capturing that feeling, I think, beautifully. It's why in this day and age are we still killing the largest, most magnificent mammals on this planet? And it is just it's mind-boggling. These animals are slow to reproduce, long-lived. Some have incredibly strong family bonds. And they're being killed for meat, for sushi. I mean, it's really it's mind blowing that there are still countries that consume and kill whales. Now, fortunately, it's only down to a small handful: Japan, Iceland, and Norway at this point. But we had an incredibly wonderful ruling. The International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled that Japan's so-called scientific whaling program, they've been, you know, because there is a commercial whaling moratorium, but they've exploited it by saying they're undertaking science. And the International Court of Justice, which is something that we wrote papers on very early on and talked about, the court ruled that what Japan was doing was, in fact, violating the moratorium, and it was not science, the way they were carrying out that current program. So that was a huge victory, and for the first time in over 100 years, Japan last year did not go back into the Southern Ocean Sanctuary and kill whales. But they are rejiggering their program now. So they are looking for international support for their new program. And we're going to do everything we can to continue to fight it so they cannot go back to the sanctuary.
All right, Kitty and Adam, we're taking a break. When we come back, we'll come back to sort of talk about the domestic front and some of the prosecutions and convictions that Adam helped secure here in the U.S. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Tell you, I love the Rolling Stones version of this song, Wild Horses, but I might like this one even a little bit better. The Sundays, an English alt-rock band from 1992, their version of Wild Horses. We're talking with Kitty Block and Adam Parascandala of the Humane Society International about battles they are fighting on animal welfare issues on a global scale. When we come back, we'll pick up the conversation with some of the victories that Adam has been able to win on the domestic front, and then maybe take a question or two from you listeners for my guests. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Adam, your bio says that you helped secure convictions against dozens of large-scale animal abusers and also helped secure the first ever prosecution for felony animal cruelty at a slaughter plant. Give us the thumbnail sketch. What did you do? Who'd you go after?
I mean, I've done a lot of cases over the years. The slaughterhouse case was really one that I'm very is very close to me. And basically, what it was we had an undercover investigator, we had a whistleblower who had reported abuses at a Bob Veal slaughter plant. So those are 3-4 day old calves that are sent to slaughter for veal consumption. And we had a whistleblower that said there are horrible abuses going on there, and we sent an undercover investigator in who documented some really atrocious handling of these young calves. Basically, they come off the truck and they get moved to the, you know, moved to the where they're going to be slaughtered. And there's a couple individuals in particular, very sort of sadistic handling, multiple shocking of the calves, kicking the calves. One gentleman even threw water on them and shocked them again to try to get them to stand up. They're very weak at that age. They've just come off this long transport. And so this was in Vermont, and the Attorney General's office ended up taking on the case, and we did managed to secure a felony conviction for one gentleman and a misdemeanor for one of the owners. And one of the things to me that is so important about this ruling is that, you know, this is literally the last few minutes of these animals' lives. And to me, this was really strong message that even those animals that were going to be, that we've accepted that we're going to be using for food or whatever use it is that humans are making out of them, that even though we've accepted that, we still have a responsibility to treat them as humanely as possible in that process, and even in those last few minutes of their lives. And so I thought that this is really an important ruling to sort of spread that message. And I think that most Americans agree that, you know, they accept the use of animals, but they agree that we should treat them as humanely as possible during that process.
You have any thoughts on the psychology of the people who work in these plants? Because I've seen those videos, the undercover videos of how they treat chickens and turkeys and pigs, and they just toss them around and laugh about it. And I just wonder if the work is so troubling that it desensitizes them in ways that even they don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not a psychologist, but I would tend to agree with you. I think that it's very hard to, when you're in that sort of situation, to remain compassionate and sort of keep your heart open, so to speak, when you're confronted with this sort of bloody task that you have to do every day. And so I think it's almost like a protection, an emotional protection for people in that situation to sort of develop a sort of antipathy against the situation and just, become hardened to it. Because if you went in there every day as your normal, everyday sort of compassionate person who, you know, gets upset when they witness pain and suffering, you would be unable to do your job. And so I think it is an environment that does sort of bring this out in people, this this need to sort of cut yourself off from that animal. It's almost like, you know, war, right? And people are sort of trained to not see the enemy as a human being in that way, because otherwise it'd be very difficult to engage in battle with them. And I think it's sort of a similar phenomenon that occurs with these people. Not that it's necessarily that, you know, sick people get involved in that line of work, but just that's sort of what happens over time when you're exposed to this kind of day-to-day, you know, suffering and violence, I guess.
Without giving away too much or putting anyone's life in danger, could you tell us whether you have any ongoing operations? Have you got people who've infiltrated this industry? Because I got to imagine it's still going on a large scale, which is why we have these ag gag laws that people have tried to pass in various states.
Yeah, it is. It is going on, of course, and you know, there are actually several organizations within the U.S. that do these kinds of investigations, and you know, at any given time, there are investigators definitely on, you know, in these places, working on ongoing investigations. And so I think that we'll be seeing more of this. And so far, thankfully, you know, we've been very successful in many places. Just recently in North Carolina, on Friday, the governor vetoed one of these ag gag bills that they were trying to pass in North Carolina. And so we've been able to fight back against a lot of them. But this is, of course, just the industry's way of trying to shut out these kinds of investigations, because used to be that they would say, you know, oh, it's just, you know, it's one bad apple, it's just, you know, a terrible person. But as more and more of these investigations come out, it's harder for the industry to say it's one bad apple, right? Because it's many different plants, many different types of animal producing facilities. Like you said, you've seen the ones with the chickens, turkeys, there have been cows, there have been pigs. And so rather than sort of saying, wait, maybe we need to see, is there something we need to change in the way that we're interacting with and working with our food product, our food animals, you know, the easier way is to just sort of say, well, let's try to shut these people out so nobody sees what goes on inside these plants.
Kitty, I want to jump back to you. One of the other troubling videos that many of us have seen now on television, I've done some stories about it, deals with shark fins. You know, sharks are not cuddly. Maybe they need a better PR agent, because people don't seem to get too upset when they see what happens to sharks. But millions and millions of sharks are being killed just for their fins, and it's to make soup. It's a tasteless soup. It has no nutritional value. It's just a status symbol. And it's just unbelievable that this goes on, and people don't realize how critical sharks are to the ocean's ecosystem. But it affects the whole oceans in so many ways to kill all these sharks. And I still see certain stores here in Las Vegas in the U.S. where this stuff is stacked up, just fins that they cut off, and then they dump the sharks back in the ocean.
Right. It's really such a horrible practice, and it's just so wasteful. I mean, you talk about the cruelty issue, which is extreme. Even though the sharks don't do a great PR job, we know they're suffering, and we are getting that word out. But it's just so wasteful. I mean, here you have this magnificent creature. Like them or not, they are vital to the ecosystem, and they are part of the oceans, and they play a vital role. And we're lopping off their fin and then just dumping their body to sink to the bottom and drown, and very much alive when they throw the body overboard. And so, as you say, I mean, this is for soup. This is not, you know, life-saving medicine. This is not for anything other than an expensive bowl of soup so you can look prestigious to your neighbors and friends. And so this practice has just eviscerated the oceans and these animals. And so we are working country by country, and in the U.S., banning the practice state by state. Of course, there is federal legislation, but we want to go further in each one of these states and actually banning the product altogether. And so this really is a consumer awareness campaign. I don't think people realize. I mean, I remember speaking with some people, and they think, well, you can take the fin, but it A, either grows back, B, they're using the whole animals. I mean, just a lot of misinformation out there. And so when you explain to people, no, this animal is killed for this small part of their body, proportionally teeny part of their body, and they're dumped back overboard live. And so when you tell them that what this is and just continuing to work on that, we are making progress. And as I said, we're going by country and shutting the practice down. So my hope, we can continue in this and we can raise enough awareness that every bowl of soup of shark fin soup that you have does directly contribute to cruelty and this huge problem of killing and wiping out these animals.
I'm trying to take a couple of quick calls from our listeners, hoping that they will keep it in the range of the topics that our guests, these two guests, can deal with. Let's go west of the Rockies. Joseph in Chico, California. Hi, Joseph. You're on with Kitty and Adam.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. I wanted to commend your guests for the work that they do, and they're definitely fighting an uphill battle. I had I'll make it as brief as possible, an incident that happened, five, 6 years ago, down in the Modesto, Stockton area, large agriculture area, down there with my girlfriend, and we're staying at one of her family's places, and next to her with all these open fields, we were alerted by these real moans and groans, and I mean, I just couldn't believe what we were hearing. We went out to see what was going on, and here were these little calves. And the girl that I was with, she knew pretty much the agricultural thing. She said, you know, these things are only weeks old that were tied to these stakes in the ground. Here's this whole huge field, and these little calves are all tied up. They couldn't move more than a few inches, and the twine is all wrapped around them and everything, so they couldn't move. There's no water, no food. They're standing in their own, dung and everything. And so we were bringing them water and trying to loosen them up and everything. The owner of this the field and obviously of these animals came out and acted like we were doing something, the most heinous act in the world. We questioned him why he was doing that, and he said it was none of our business and that they were raising them, that's the way they do it, there's nothing wrong with that. We went back to her dad's house, who works for the sheriff's department down there, explained it to him, and he said he'd look into it and everything. 2 days later, we find out that the sheriff in that area said, you know, that we were in violation because we went on this guy's property and we were going to get in more trouble if we pursued this. And I just couldn't believe it. I just said, you know, the hearts of many people are really waxing cold, and it's almost like they're immune to it. And I hope more people will listen to this program and to your guest and really understand that if they were in any way mistreating your pet or anything you loved or any kind of living creature, you know, you got to do something about it. Some people have to, you know, make a stand. And I know there's a lot of things going on in this world right now. There's a lot of causes, and there's a lot of people that are being asked to donate and to volunteer and to do things. But this is a worthwhile cause, because if you just keep letting the people who have all the big money legislate things, and you literally blow the whistle and you get into trouble, there's something wrong with our system.
Joseph, let me allow our guest to comment on that. Thanks for the call. Adam, you must deal with local law enforcement, all the investigations you've been on. You know, you're in a ranching community. Everybody knows everybody. I would imagine it's tough to get local law enforcement engaged in cases like this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would like to thank the caller for, you know, making an effort to report, you know, this kind of abuse. It is really difficult. I mean, a lot of times it's true that the things that law enforcement will respond very readily, if it's a dog or a cat, it can be very difficult sometimes. to get that same response when you're talking about farm animals. And sometimes it's a misunderstanding on the part of law enforcement. Most cruelty laws exempt common agricultural practices. So these are sort of accepted agricultural practices that are done, widely done, that, you know, we might not allow on a dog or cat. For example, most bulls are castrated without any anesthesia. That would be completely illegal if that were somebody did that with their dog, right? But sometimes this gets misinterpreted by law enforcement. There's a lot of confusion about what that means. It doesn't mean that the animals are not protected from cruelty. And certainly the situation the caller was talking about, when you have an animal that's tied out, you know, in the middle of a field, I assume in the sun, don't know if it was summer, it gets pretty hot there in Stockton and Modesto without any water, access to water, that would clearly be a violation of the law. And so we do spend a lot of time doing training with law enforcement agencies as well, and trying to educate the law enforcement community that, you know, that these cruelty laws do cover animals that are used for food production as well.
Thanks to our callers. I'm sorry we don't have time to get to more calls. Maybe a little bit later we'll go back to the phones. Kitty, what's your top priority? What's on the top of your agenda on the international front?
Well, thank you. And also, I just wanted to follow up one thing on the caller's question.
Sure.
Just, there are tons of causes out there, but there are a few causes that we can affect every single day. And just the food choices you make, find out where your food's coming from, how it was prepared. Just ask these questions, and you're going to be able to contribute to stopping these practices. So it's sort of overwhelming because there is so much going on, but it is empowering because we do have choices, and every day we can make a choice of what we eat and what food we choose. So I just wanted to add that. As far as the global scale, I mean, as you said at the outset of this call, there are so many issues impacting animals, and the Humane Society of the United States and Humane Society International, we focus on protecting all animals. And we do that from dogs and for farm animals and wildlife. And so for me, it's really taking the great successes that we've had in the U.S. and in other parts of the country and expanding that out. And so it's working with trying to stop the killing of rhinos, elephants, whales, the spread of huge factory farms in so many parts of the world. The protection of these dogs that are going into the dog meat trade. I mean, it's just really a very broad but important, incredibly important body of work. And I'm just excited that we're expanding. I mean, we continue to grow and grow into different parts of the world and work with folks on the ground and help build capacity and professionalize a lot of these fledgling animal groups and animal causes. And so we are a resource for them and the support for them to make a difference for the animals in their communities. So that's my mission, and that's what we're very excited about.
Thank you very much. Adam, very quickly, your top priority?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that we've definitely seen is that, you know, we live now in a global world, and like Kitty mentioned, you know, these things that we're sort of stamping out and are getting some successes in some parts of the world, if we're not diligent, they're just springing up elsewhere. For example, as we have more restrictions on factory farming here in the U.S. and in Europe, we start to see these companies trying to export their factory farms to other parts of the world. And similarly, with dog fighting, you know, there's still a lot of dog fighting that occurs in the U.S., but we've been very successful with raids and busting many of these major dog fighters in the U.S., and it's becoming more difficult for them. But what we've seen is that they are now engaging with other countries, and there are you know, dozens and dozens of countries around the world now that are involved in this sort of global dog fighting world. And so, you know, it's become a priority for us to address this on a global level and not just in the U.S. And I think that's a big reason for this, you know, sort of expansion with HSI is with Humane Society International is that just stamping it out in the U.S. is not enough. These people are opportunistic and they're looking elsewhere. And so,
All right, Adam. Thank you, Adam and Kitty. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck.